Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Sneha Anavarapu, the host of this channel, and today I have the pleasure of being in conversation with Dr. Amit Rai, the author of Jugaad Time, Ecologies of Everyday Hacking in India, published by Duke University Press in 2019. Amit Rai is a reader in creative industries and arts organizing at Queen Mary University of London. Welcome to the show, Amit. So thrilled to be chatting with you today.
Hi, thanks for the invitation, Sneha. Looking forward to the conversation.
Excellent. So, you know, I was hoping that we'd get started with you telling us a little bit about yourself, perhaps your journey into and through academia.
Mm-hmm. Yes. My journey into academia, I think, began toward the end of my college years, where I became seriously sort of interested in different forms of social criticism, specifically Black feminist writings, liberation theology. I minored in theology and majored in literature as an undergraduate. Mm-hmm. And that sort of also brought me into the kind of big, bad realm of theory. And sort of try to, you know, situate my own self as a first generation immigrant to the United States, living in what in that time period, and this was in the 80s, was called the sort of Asian American formation, and then also to understand myself as a diasporic. All of this went into my engagement with, for instance, I wrote my senior thesis on Black women's writing and the question of subjectivity. So all of that sort of enabled me to pose certain questions of power and I began to think very critically about my own sort of history and the context in which I was trying to study. And study what? I was interested very early on in emancipatory movements. Emancipatory social movements. So from there, what happened was I went to India. After I graduated college, I went back to India to my hometown, to the town that I was born in, Bhopal, where I had, many relatives and friends. And what I did was I got a job at an English daily. The Dainik Bhaskar had a English daily at the time. I think it was called the National Mail or something. And I got a job sort of doing the education beat in the city. But it was a very volatile time. This is the end of the 80s, the beginning of the 90s. And as you I'm sure well know, and your listeners probably are well aware, this was the time of course, the entrance of India into the IMF sort of world. It was the moment of liberalization of the economy. It was also the moment of the release of the Mandal Commission report around reservations for Dalits. And it was also, of course, the time of the ratcheting up of Hindutva nationalism. And I was in India, I was in Bhopal, in the city, on a scooter, on the day of the first storming of the mosque, of the Babri Masjid, all of that shaped what I thought was possible and what I thought was necessary politically, in terms of, for instance, what needed to be learned. What do I need to learn? Mm-hmm. What do I need to know to be able to contribute to collective formations of resistance, and also, you know, how one can think about India's project of secularism and whither secularism in India. So all of those things were swirling around in my brain, and I applied to go to graduate school. And I went to graduate school in Northern California, and I got a degree at Stanford in a program called Modern Thought and Literature, which was an interdisciplinary program, and that strong emphasis was on really understanding, you know, different disciplinary ways of knowing, and why in this discipline a question was being posed in this way, and why in another discipline question was being posed in a different way. And so I focused on what I guess one could call a sort of broadly post-colonial cultural studies and anthropology. Those were sort of my two areas of focus in my graduate work. And I was focusing on 19th and 20th century literatures in South Asia and in Britain. So looking specifically at colonial relations of culture, I was looking at the history of cultural anthropology and the formation of the anthropological gaze, how the anthropological framework came about through the colonial encounter itself. I became just sort of, I don't know, one could say fascinated, I could also say mired in a certain kind of post-structuralist philosophy, post-structuralism, and the big names, of course, people will know, but the ones that particularly kind of mesmerized me at the time were people like Foucault and Derrida, and you know, Gayatri Spivak's sort of bringing Derrida into the English-speaking world. And then more generally, the relationship of intersectionality at the time. Kimberly Crenshaw's work on intersectionality was very important in critical race studies, and how that was also an important way of thinking about questions of solidarity. And so the sort of Black feminist analysis of different forms of power and how the Black woman's body is at the intersection of many different dynamics and many different machines of capture, one might say. All of that was very important to my understanding of not only research, but also pedagogy, what one could affirm in the classroom. And we were talking here, you know, about classrooms that were highly policed. I was teaching second, third year graduate student at Stanford, and it was a very, very fraught campus. And in those days, back in the 90s, the discussion was, well, who's PC? Are you right? PC? Is anyone PC? What does PC mean? And those kinds of questions of and the sharpening of those questions of political enunciation and the position in which one can speak from, and who can one represent, and what is representation? What does it mean to represent another's voice, and so on and so forth? Though, well, those questions were being fought over in the classroom, in you know, the culture wars that had hotted up in the 80s and had really sort of exploded in the 90s. That was also very much a part of my intellectual formation. And I was also trained, of course, in post-colonial criticism. And right. For me, post-colonial criticism was certainly a way of understanding these geopolitical dimensions of everyday life, and understanding, of course, the ongoing legacies of colonial domination. But post-colonial criticism was also a place for me of thinking about solidarities. I sort of foreground that issue for me, the question of solidarity, because it has been a continuous one. And I will talk mm-hmm. about that toward the end, I suppose. I published several articles as a graduate student, and you know, this was at a time where when post-colonial criticism was very popular in academic presses. So I say that as both a problem and a kind of sort of explanation of what was going on. But I published articles on, for instance, images of Elvis in Hindi films. And so I looked at Shammi Kapoor through the framework of Homi Bhabha's notion of mimicry, colonial mimicry, and then doing readings of, and really representational readings of particular films focusing on the question of the woman, the subaltern woman, and her quote-unquote voice. So those are the kinds of, that's how I sort of began sort of into media studies, began my journey into cultural criticism. What I think was probably, you know, a really good job for that year. In 1995, I got a full-time position at the New School for Social Research. And of course, you know, the New School for Social Research is a storied place. It has a very radical history, and it was a place where different kinds of radical thought was still possible. And I was teaching at the undergraduate college there, and was abled and enabled and supported by colleagues to do experimental things in the classroom and teach experimental topics. So that was really important as my first job in academia. And then in 2004, I moved to Florida State University, where I was teaching similar things to the New School. And Florida is Florida, and you can see how they voted today. But Florida, where I was Tallahassee, which was really southern Georgia, and 15 minutes in either direction of Tallahassee landed you in Ku Klux Klan country. So that kind of environment, that kind of white supremacist environment, also then gave me further kind of concrete sort of context through which I could understand these different interests that I had accrued. In 2010, well, in 2009, I got a senior fellowship with the Fulbright Foundation, mm-hmm. and was able to go to India to do a year-long study on the question of gender and mobile phones. And that was really the sort of one of the important places where I began thinking about Jugar. And so that happened in 2009. And then in 2010, while really I was still on my fellowship, I got another job. And at this time I got a job, something completely different and completely out of my field in some ways, but I got a job in a business school. I got a job in a left-leaning business school that was sort of being put together by two amazing academics, Professor Jerry Hanlon, who does work on organizational behavior, and the other person was Stefano Harney. And Stefano Harney, I knew from New York, and he and I shared some certain circles together, but I'd never met him. And so, and when I landed up here, it became clear that Harney and I had, you know, very specific kinds of intersecting political and theoretical interests. And of course, Stefano is known today as the co-writer of co-author of The Undercommons, one of the books that he and Fred Moten have written together. And Stefano also reintroduced me in some ways to a different aspect of the Black radical tradition. At the time when I got here at Queen Mary, this was already a place that had a strong post-autonomous presence. So there was a lot of Italian autonomists here, post-workerists, one might say. And so the posing of the question of the political in Marxist political economy through Italian Marxism was very important to me, and has remained very important to me over the past 10 years. People like Arianna Bove, Valeria Graziano, Matteo Pasquinelli, Camille Barbagallo, and Matteo Mandarini, all these people were very, very formative at a time where a lot of things for me were still forming. So today I teach in the fields of ethics and business, critical marketing studies, transnational creative industry studies. I also convene a seminar at the Dutch Art Institute in the Roaming Academy there. And the seminar is on the relationship of post-colonial theory to the Black radical tradition.
Wow. That's really interesting. And thank you for taking us down this route, as it's very inspiring to see someone do such different and interesting things. And, you know, Well, I was also curious, you did just mention it, but perhaps you could give us a bit of a deep dive into how the research for this particular project developed and, like how this book was conceived.
Yeah. So I've written three books, and my first book was on the 18th and 19th century around questions of humanitarianism and the emergence of humanitarianism and the question of race and colonialism. That was called Rule of Sympathy. My second book was called Untimely Bollywood, and it was based on an anthropological project of understanding the shifts and changes in film going and media consumption in India at the moment when India was moving from the single screen talkie to the multiplex. And I call it the multiplex for advisedly. In other words, today, almost all malls that are built in India have a cinema. Have some capacity for cinema going. So, the close linkage between consumption, neoliberal consumption, and a certain form of cinema going and media consumption has been, closely tied together. Certainly, this has been happening in America since the 50s. But as neoliberalism took off in India in the 90s and 2000s, this connection became almost second nature. It became almost like a natural connection. So I wanted to explore what was happening to cinema going, to media consumption at this moment. And I spent a year at Lily Talkies in Bhopal. And would just basically go in every day, talk to staff, hang out with and interview moviegoers and things like that. So that sort of was what enabled me to write Untimely Bollywood. But in that moment of writing Untimely Bollywood, I also realized that there was something going on with technology, something that was both uniquely Indian, but also something that was shared and part of a global shift. So this is for me also something that is a tension in my work. And that is, are there styles of cinema going? First day, first show, for instance, right? First day, first show is a thing in India. It used to be at least. And that sort of ability to claim I've done first day, first show. There's something very, very, I would say Indian about it. And when I say Indian, I'm also wary that I'm homogenizing a very, very heterogeneous country. But just to put it in those very general terms right now. And then the question of what was happening with digital technologies. So, so that connection between a certain kind of style of a certain kind of, a lot of it is localized, but a certain kind of style that many people in India from other parts of India can recognize. Oh, that's a person enthralled in a movie or something like that. Well, that kind of culture of movie going was changing in dynamic relationship with the new digital technologies. That dynamic feedback, right? So there's a feedback between a changing technological infrastructure and a you know, differently changing and differently rhythmed set of habituations. So the relationship of habit to technology was something that was really posed in sharp terms for me when I was doing the research for Untimely Bollywood. And then that became very, very important as I began, as I turned to thinking about the mobile phone. When I was in India doing all of this work on Untimely Bollywood, what I was sort of, what I was interested in was how cinema was going from kind of an alone standing, a sort of, you know, a completely autonomous, a largely autonomous kind of media culture to something that was much more distributed. So that, you know, I was looking at the marketing of films and the long and longer sort of train of how these films became a marketing part of a marketing campaign. And so then looking at how the radio was involved, and of course the radio had been involved for quite some time, but how then different ways in which the mobile phone became linked to marketing a film. Well, that sort of initial introduction to how increasingly from the early 2000s, the cinema people, the film people all over India were using the mobile phone to market and then also to distribute and to kind of get sort of the worms, the Bollywood worm, earworms, or, you know, hearing worms into people's ears. So you have to hear that song, that little snippet of the song again and again, that kind of thing that happened through a distributed network of media. That became an important way of understanding what then subsequently happened to the mobile phone. And so those kinds of interests, the question of technology, the question of habituation, the question of power, the question of globalization and consumption, all of those things I took forward into my research on mobile phones, which I began really in 2007 around, and then was able to, you know, devote some concentrated time in 2009. So the sort of, I mean, and the other sort of major thing I took from, and I guess this is obvious when, if people have a sense of the book, if you just look at the table of contents, the other big thing here is the question of affect. Mm-hmm. What is affect? What is an affective atmosphere? What are affective dispositions? What are affective dynamics in relationship between technology and habit? What is affect? Now, of course, I understand affect is not reducible to emotion. I understand affect, and again, this comes out of a particular philosophical and political conversation happening right now, but happening for many, many years. And that is that affect is the capacity to affect and be affected, the capacity to sense and act in the world. That is, again, to understand the body as in an open ecological context, in an open ecological structure, one might say. So affect to me became a very important organizing framework, and that carried again through Untimely Bollywood to Jugar Time. And what does the term affect allow me to do? It allows me, and of course the people who I've been in conversation with, and we'll turn to that in a second, but it's a framing that foregrounds a body irreducible to consciousness. It foregrounds the dynamism of a body irreducible to language. Now, notice I'm not saying to the exclusion of consciousness or to the exclusion of language. I'm not I'm not at all making a claim, and some people I understand do make this claim, but I'm not making this claim that affect is somehow better than or more interesting than language or the notion of consciousness. It's simply to situate affect in a broader field than either consciousness or language, a broader field of relations, a broader field of relations which are not controlled and not reducible to language or consciousness. So that's the sort of important foregrounding of affect that I was able to, that I've carried through into Dzogchen time. The other constant, or the other sort of constant interest, was the relationship of technology to gender. Mm-hmm. In what ways were different media technologies gendered, and in what way was gender as a form of power operating through different technologies? And that again carried through from thinking about the single screen talkie as a gendered space, mm-hmm. to understanding the mobile phone as an intimate device that could potentially disrupt patriarchal strictures of the house. All of that became interesting. It was really, the new book opened up another aspect of, an aspect that I think I had recognized, but an aspect that became sharper for me, and that is the way in which people work around obstacles in India, the way they do not let a particular, let's say, intellectual property, do not let, let's say, a particular caste stricture stop them, even though these might be in very many ways debilitating forms of control that people, and I here I'm specifically thinking about subaltern communities of struggle against constituted and dominant powers, that resistance keeps going. And that sort of prior field of recalcitrance, that prior field of resistance, was also what made me think that there's something about Dzogchen that gets at some of these historical and very material dynamics of power. Is that good with that?
Yeah, I don't know. That's great. Thank you. Okay. This is actually a really good introduction to also the central term of the book, Dzogchen. And I think we got a sense of how the book thinks about it and thinks through it. So thank you for that. I would just love to sort of quickly get into the chapters, which are just so full of very rich ethnographic work. So in chapter one, you draw on ethnographic work on mobile phone ecologies in Mumbai and Delhi that I think you and your team conducted between 2009 and 17. And you posit that phone companies have adapted Dzogchen to their business model, but also have tried to orient customers and employees to a new sensorium. I would invite you to tell our listeners a little more about what this means and the implications of this corporate capture of Dzogchen as innovation.
Yes. So Dzogchen just really, really briefly means work around. It means, it could be also understood as a kind of a trick, a kind of a con. Many people use it as a way of foregrounding their authenticity. Oh, you're a Dzogchenu. You know how the ins and outs of a particular, a particular arena of power, and so you know how to negotiate that arena and do what you need to do. So you're a Dzogchenu. Well, over the past, I'd say 10, 15 years, Dzogchen has become an object of a business and management scholarship. And what is the capture here? The capture is that Dzogchen is thought of as frugal innovation. That is innovation that poor people do, basically. And the innovation that poor people do, of course, for business and management types means that that's something that they can learn from and create monopoly capital from, monopoly value from. So Jugar can also be thought of as a marketing gimmick. And it has been in various guises been used as a marketing gimmick. And what does this mean? It means, oh, Jugar is the next big thing, and Jugar is a way of sort of producing the next big thing all the time. So it's a way of thinking about how the new is newly fetishized in India today. The other thing about Jugar, of course, is that it's ostensibly a Indian word, although it's very difficult to find the etymology of this word. And some people claim that it comes from Punjabi. Some people claim that it comes from Hindi. It's also used in Bengali, Jogar, and so on and so forth. But the term, if you think about it for a moment, sounds strikingly like a Portuguese word, which is jugar, which means what? It means to play. So and of course the term play or the concept of play is very alive in Jugar practice. To be able to play with the conditions that history or politics or a particular caste domination has bequeathed you, and to play with them, and then play with those conditions and rearrange them in a way that allows you to work around them. Well, that is a kind of, I would almost go so far as to say it's a revolutionary kind of play. Well, all of that also produces the idea that Jugar, I mean, and notice the irony here that possibly, I'm not making any absolute claims to this because I'm not an etymologist, but I've done some sort of background research on this. And that is that, you know, Jugar could possibly very well come from the Portuguese language, not Indian at all. But today, Jugar, in a variety of contexts, is used as a sign of Indian authenticity. So there's a deep irony there. There's a deep irony that, you know, in my old guise as post-colonial critic, I would have, you know, just gotten very excited about. I don't so much anymore. But Indian authenticity is also something that's at work in the culture of Jugar and its marketing. I think of Jugar as subjective form. What is the relationship of Jugar to the sort of the way in which subjectivity is formed under neoliberal capital in India today? Well, what does that mean? It's a foregrounding of what? Innovation. It's a foregrounding of entrepreneurship. It's a foregrounding of competitive individualism. All of these, you know, quote unquote, value added ways in which people turn themselves into human capital, to paraphrase both Marx and Foucault here. These are an important, they're important dynamics within the uptake of Jugar in business and management. So I'm very interested in and very critical of thinking about Jugar in these ways, because of course that is it's an abstraction of Jugar. Once again, a kind of making Jugar into a gimmick for, you know, a venture capitalist or something like that. I also encountered Jugar in my research as a kind of an elite style of, you know, an elite style of, yeah, I can get it done. Don't you worry. This is the kind of interviews that I was having with value-added mobile phone people in Noida. And they would, you know, every other word was Jugar. And who's the Jugaru today, and so on and so forth. This is in the mid-2010s and so on and so forth. And it might not be so used nowadays as much, but it was also for me a way in which there was an elite appropriation of Jugar. And that elite appropriation of Jugar was a kind of like, hey, I'm authentic and I don't have to follow what all the managers do because I've got my own style and I'm going to create value that way. So that was also happening in the kind of mobile phone cultures that I was researching. The other thing about Jugar is that a Jugar is, when someone is performing a Jugar, it's for a particular use. It's not to turn that Jugar into money or kind of a way of getting something else. It's in fact something that's immediately and directly useful. Well, the uptake of Jugaar in business management is an abstraction of that use into something that can be exchanged for something else. So it's another way in which use value is transformed into exchange value today. And Jugaar is that weird combination of use and exchange value, which is, I think, quite volatile. The last thing I would say here is that in terms of the corporate capture of Jugaar is the question of intellectual property. If you consider what's happened in India since 1995, and I use that year very is an important year, and that's the year of TRIPS, of the World Trade Organization intellectual property regime known as TRIPS, mm-hmm. and that of course started a long battle in India of what is intellectual property. Why should we respect it? How can we respect it and still be within the global community when we are also coming to terms with the fact that 90% of our economy is not in the formal sector? Well, Jugaar can also be then used as a way of developing or generating intellectual property. And again, this is something to be very critical of. If that's the case, that Jugaar can be linked to intellectual property, can be linked to that kind of capture of quote unquote innovation and turning it into exclusive monopoly rights, it can also be the obverse. Jugaar can also be part of a commoning. And this is mm-hmm. something that I was very interested in thinking about, how Jugaar and collective practices of Jugaar are mechanisms of commoning resources, but also commoning knowledge, the knowledge of the Jugaar itself. So these are all very, I think, important sort of dynamics that I tried to keep in play as much as I could in the book.
Great. Yeah, thank you. That was, I think, very helpful, especially to think about the corporate capture of Jugaar and its sort of its etymology and all of the contradictions and contingencies within. So in chapter two, you focus on what you call diagramming India's emergent sensorium in the forms of affect, habit, and control in business process outsourcing. And you shed light on a new ontology of sensation in the domain of digital culture in India. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about your method and also why thinking about this emergent sensorium is key to understanding neoliberalism in India today?
Great. I mean, this phrase, and I think I probably overuse it in the book, but it's an important one, an ontology of sensation, an ecology of sensation. I use this word all the time in the book, and I've begun to sort of understand a little bit better subsequent to its publication why it's important to me. And that is, it is an important way of questioning an objective illusion of thought. The objective mm-hmm. illusion of thought is that we take product over process. We are constantly confusing, and this is this happens in many, many, many different cultures differently, but there is a focus on product over process. So in the domain of the digital, in the domain of digital culture in India, these products, of course, are everywhere. They're multiplying, these little electronic gadgets, astrological reading that you got on your WhatsApp. These are all products that are up for all sorts of different kinds of sharing and different kinds of modes of consumption. But for me, the question of what processes enabled those products to circulate as commodities, that to me was both a question of returning to Marx, but it was also mm-hmm. a question of understanding the body. How is the body in a mobile phone ecology activated? How is it sort of tapped and made a kind of a zone of interconnection, an interzone. The body becomes an interzone when the the devices that we are so intimately connected to, these kinds of interzones, the body becoming an interzone, that to me is a way of understanding how the material flows of media, but also forms of monetization and value creation, and of course, the specific embodied habits of the phone itself form an entire ontology or a mode of being and becoming. And that to me was, well, I needed a method to understand that. And of course, there was quite a few historical precedents for me to draw on here. I mean, I also would want to say that I was explicit in being critical of the overwhelming representational frameworks that continue to dominate cultural criticism today. So for me, the turn to affect was also a critique of the representational. In Jugar time, I come up with this phrase, which, you know, is okay. I can't say that I want to brand it or anything, but it's a phrase called affective ethnography, and that's the method. If you want to give a phrase to it, but there are many ways to describe it. What does it mean? It tries to understand potentiality, and it tries to understand possibility without reducing them to each other. That the potential is not the possible. The possible is already given by the actual, but the potential, what is potential in a given field, is much broader than that. So affective ethnographies would be able to pose potential that are emergent, potentials that would be emergent given a rejigged or new set of interactions in a particular ecology. And what are these interactions? These interactions are based in capacities, the body's capacity to affect and be affected, a mobile phone's affordances to be able to get a signal and to be able to generate information in a way that can be consumed, but also in a way that can be data mined. The other aspect of affective ethnographies was also bringing the process back to all of these products. And so to understand how a mobile phone becomes part of a city's metabolic processes and becomes a technology of dynamic feedbacks. That, I think, all of these sort of elements, and of course the other couple of important elements here is that we're looking at structures, we're looking at infrastructures that have multiple causalities and mutual causalities. These are things that don't have just a simple cause and effect relationship, but in fact are have a distributed agency that needs to be understood in its complexities. So that is another way of understanding sensorium. The word sensorium, of course, it comes from Walter Benjamin and many others. But that term is also a way in which, for Benjamin, he was able to understand the rise of fascism. And for me, it certainly also is linked to the understanding of the rise of a particular kind of Hindutva power in India. But the term sensorium is also for me a place of revolutionary potentiality. And that to me is, again, a very important thing. Another way of understanding affective ethnographies is by this phrase, embodied ethics. And embodied ethics is another way of understanding how one might construct an affective ethnography. The shift from representation to something else, well, what is that something else? I make some claims in Jugar time, and I'm not sure if they're completely. Anyways, and the claims are that that what I'm involved in, what I think is necessary to move out of representational captures or representational reductions of, for instance, affect, is that we produce ethical diagrams. We produce, mm-hmm. we engage in a diagrammatic thought, and we engage in a diagrammatic practice. And what does that mean? Well, you can understand the word diagram as in the phrase reverse diagramming engineer, an engineering diagram. Mm-hmm. Through an engineering diagram, one can reverse products into a variety of different processes. And that to me is a way of understanding, in the words of Bergson, how we should act as people of thought and think as people of action. And that sort of, I think celebration, or a kind of celebration, and I hope not an uncritical celebration, but an argument around the diagrammatic is important in the book.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks. Moving on, in chapter 3, the chapter that I must admit I enjoyed the most, you focus on the affective and metabolic dimensions of women's domestic labor in the connected smart city. And in doing so, you think through Partha Chatterjee's arguments vis-a-vis the nationalist resolution of the women's question. And this chapter then presents a biopolitical analysis of subaltern media practices and the feminist critique of social reproduction in the context of post-colonial displacements in urban India. I would love it if you could share with our listeners how the Jugaad framework, if I may use that phrase, deepens our understanding of urban metabolism of technology, kinship, and care in the context of gender relations in urbanizing cities.
Well, I'm glad you liked that chapter, because it was also a joy for me to write and to think about and to think with people I'm in solidarity with, people struggling around, for instance, the construction of social space in urban cities, in urban areas, and that is the domination of men of the urban space. And this is, of course, the work done by Shilpa Phadke and her colleagues. And that work is called Why Loiter, was an attempt in a collective mode to take social space back. What is an urban metabolics? An urban metabolics is, once again, to foreground the question of what are the processes that constitute a neoliberal city. One of those processes that I focused on was the sort of transformation of urban space through big data, and what big data was offering development. Urban development in India, and how that smart city framework was being marketed by the Modi government and others, but the idea that we'll have 100 smart cities by 2014 or something like that. I mean, the claims are huge. The claims are of modernity themselves, and of course in the book, I make it a very sort of strong point to point out the ways in which the smart city paradigm is in fact an elite-driven form of urban transformation. But then the question of care is interesting to me. This term care has been radically repositioned in the work of, for instance, Silvia Federici, Camille Barbagallo, the people who are the socialist feminists who are taking this question of the social reproduction of the home and understanding it through the unpaid labor of women, and mm-hmm. how the commodity labor power is reproduced in very particular ways, and how that reproduction involves people in a capitalist and a non-capitalist economy at the same time. And so that the domestic sphere is both inside and outside of capital. That to me became a very important side of struggle, an important place to pose critically the question of how life hacking, or Jugaad, another phrase of understanding Jugaad is life hacking, how life hacking was important to, for instance, mm-hmm. how recipes are shared, how a dish is experimented with, how particular sources of sustenance are in fact sourced. So, in other words, what kinds of workarounds are necessary for different households to reproduce themselves? And the households that I sort of was focused on and was able and enabled to focus on through the work of my co-researchers working in Delhi and Bombay, Shiva Rachna and Anisha. I mean, they're amazing scholars who researchers who are helping me do this research, and enabled sort of conversations to happen that I wouldn't necessarily have been able to have myself. But that those conversations had to do with, for instance, how Dalit domestic workers were helping to reproduce the middle class upper caste home precisely through jugar ecologies. And that kind of complicity of the quote unquote formal economy home, the upper caste, upper class home, the complicity of that ecology, that particular formation with the subaltern Dalit ecologies necessary to really quote unquote get their desires fulfilled. Mm-hmm. That I think was an important part of thinking about care and kinship and how it was being contested and in some ways also ramified. So the home again became a place where I wanted to go from product to process. I wanted to put the home into its dynamic motion, and to do that at the level of a concept or the level of analysis that would allow us to diagram those relations of power so that we might change them, so that people would change them, and people are changing them quite actively. So in that sense, care or what we might call a feminist care ethics is also a kind of action on the environment. And it is the commitment or the affirmation of creating environments for action. And it's also to make the strong argument that in some fundamental way care is outside of capital. That care and capital do not map onto each other in fundamental ways. The sort of what is happening to the domestic, and I just repeat this again when I have this conversation, is that the mobile phone actually causes men to be anxious. The mobile phone in the home causes male anxiety, and it causes male anxiety because there's a securitization of the home that is threatened by the mobile mm-hmm. phone, by women in the home using the mobile phone in ways that could not be controlled by the men in the home. And this is usually the reason why all the women in a certain kind of middle class home, all the women share one phone, and the men each have their own phones. Those kinds of strictures, those kind of patriarchal structures of domination that I think are still quite strong, operative in some ways, and in some places getting stronger. Some places they're becoming more open for contestation. Well, all of those dynamics that to me also are bound up with questions of class and caste, that to me was a way, was a site through which a method of considering the metabolics of urban power, that was a way of bringing the process back to the product of the home.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that you brought that up, because my next question was actually about these sorts of hybrid practices such as Jugaad that suggest a prior field of subaltern recalcitrance and invention in the practices of contemporary informal sectors in like smart cities in India. And I particularly enjoyed how you developed this idea of the metabolic plasticity of in terms of informal urban economies in smart cities. Can you tell us a little bit about what thinking about plasticity alongside activism practice can tell us about the contemporary Indian city?
I think the term the metabolic is important because, I mean, the danger here is that we're going to reduce the city to a body. There is a danger. Mm-hmm. So there's always a danger with all metaphors. As one of my favorite philosophers once said, we use metaphors when we forget how to act. So, but that, with all of that caveat being said, I think the term metabolic and metabolism is a way of understanding, again, how things are interconnected, how processes are interconnected, how questions of power grid, how questions of water distribution, how traffic, how certain air flows, and of course, how policy, all of them are linked politically, they're linked through the administration of a city. And so it makes sense to begin to understand the city as something that is not only for humans and not only created by humans. This is another way and I think throughout the book, I'm also quite aware that one of the things that is coming to an end is the anthropocentrism of much mm-hmm. of anthropological thought and so on and so forth, and contemporary, certainly, geographical thought and cultural criticism. And that is that the city is more than human, and its metabolisms cannot be, its processes of reproduction, its processes of construction cannot be reduced to human needs. And so that, that we as humans must have a little bit more humility and understand that quote unquote created, in fact, has become bigger than us, and that has become involved in ecologies that are not of our creation and not directly of our control. So the metabolic becomes an important way in which we can reconnect with non-human processes. So that's one thing. And then the question of plasticity. Well, what is this? Of course, the term plastic has bad connotations today, and of course for good reason. But the term plasticity, which the philosopher, German philosopher Hegel used, and has been recently taken up by the French philosopher Catherine Malabou, and who's used this term to think about the brain's plasticity. And when you think about the brain's plasticity, what you're thinking about is the brain's potentiality for change. And so the term plasticity, when applied to the urban space, is also this kind of encouragement or a tendency to try to think about various dynamics, tendency to change in a city. And in that sense, you can see that plasticity, or you could understand plasticity as a way of grappling with how a city is differentiating from itself, that its plasticity, its realm of potentiality, is in fact that realm where it is self-differentiating. It's difference differentiating, one might put it. So that's, in that sense, plasticity is a way of thinking about the conditions of how thinking about the conditions through which a city transforms. So for those reasons, I thought the term metabolic plasticity a very useful one. It foregrounds processes of differentiation. That's the other thing, that difference becomes not a problem, but actually an affirmative dynamic happening in the city, happening through its heterogeneous metabolism. It also foregrounds questions of the strategies and tactics of subaltern struggle. Because if a city is changing, it means its people are changing, involved in the change, involved in new habituations, and of course, in the contestation of cities that are becoming increasingly privatized and turned into elite playgrounds. Well, those are all places of strategies and tactics of subaltern struggle. And that is also something I wanted to foreground. And I guess the last thing that I would say about the term metabolic plasticity is that it allows a thinking of emergent properties. And what is an emergent property? It's a property that emerges from the interaction of within a multiplicity. So the city is thought of as a multiplicity, but when new elements enter into that multiplicity and start interacting with other elements of that multiplicity, let's say a mobile phone interacting with, let's say, the social practice of Jugar, suddenly you have an emergent property operating. And that emergent property is in fact the conjunction between these different dynamics. So I think that was very important for me to also think about something that cannot be predicted beforehand.
Right.
And that also was an important way of getting out of the representational framework and thinking specifically about how things emerge in their dynamism.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think this is also a great juncture at which to introduce a question that you had sort of alluded to in previous answers, but you know, to use your own words in the form of a question, how does Jugaad contribute to the ongoing struggles for non-capitalist, anti-capitalist economic equality and democratic social emancipation in India and indeed globally? In fact, does it contribute to this at all? What are the revolutionary potentialities of Jugaad?
This is the question I kind of end with in the book. And I think today, I think I have some better clarity around it. Why is that? I think today I understand that Jugaad in itself has no politics. There's no mm-hmm. intrinsic politics to Jugaad. Jugaad can be used from everything from, Jugaad is used in misogynistic practices of terrorizing women with a mobile phone. It's also mm-hmm. used by Dalit communities to work around caste oppression in a variety of contexts in the city. So in that sense, Jugaad as such has no politics. It has no already given politics. That having been said, I think there are dynamics and tendencies in Jugaad culture that are profoundly troubling to the constituted modes of power in India today. And this is why mm-hmm. I wrote the book, that not to necessarily resuscitate or save Jugaad from the baddies who might try to capture it, but to suggest that different movements for social change, for emancipatory transformation can understand aspects of Jugaad as a part of their strategy and tactics, that Jugaad can be one strategy. It could be something that enables a kind of defetishization of intellectual property, a kind of putting into historical context the formation of caste power and class power and so on and so forth, a way in which to not take seriously the patriarchal strictures around the home, all of these ways. And of course, it comes with dangers, comes with dangers for women, for people who are lower caste when they speak out, when they act in these ways, because to get caught out doing a Jugaad is also a very dangerous thing. So mm-hmm. all of these things come with dangers, and I'm not trying to underplay them, but what I'm interested in thinking about it are the ways in which Jugaad can be a useful strategy or useful tactic. I mean, I often think of it this way as well, in which that writing this book was a way of me getting around a business school. But writing the book in a way that was in itself not Jugaad was also important. Mm-hmm. That research cannot be conducted as workarounds. Usually, I mean, there are aspects of research that can, but generally what one wants is, and I guess I'm an old fashioned Marxist in this way. I believe in rigorous criticism and I believe in rigorous mm-hmm. critique, and one cannot simply willy nilly apply Jugaad in all contexts and in various different practices and say, hey, we're all Jugaads. That's not at all where I was going with this book. I wanted to sort of, begin to think critically, you know, philosophically and politically about this practice. And I think I was mildly successful in that. I'm hopeful that this practice can stop being a fetish, and we can, instead of turning jugaar into a product, we can understand mm-hmm. jugaar in terms of its processes. And those processes, yeah. to me, are involved in revolutionary becoming.
I think that's like a perfect note on which to end this discussion of your wonderful book. But before we let you go, I'm sure we would all love to know, what are you working on currently, and what might we expect to see from you in the near future?
Right. So I have been for the past about 2 years looking at the problem of attention, mm-hmm. and how attention is being mobilized through a variety of media platforms, how platform capitalism itself is basically rooted in the modulation of attention, and I'm interested in it in terms of the relationship of attention to creativity. When is it, and so I'm working in the creative industries, critical creative industry studies, and one of the things that I keep coming across here in the UK is strategies to maximize creative potential in workplaces. Well, how are people going about doing that? They're saying, well, we need to be mindful. And of course, by mindful, they mean Eastern meditation. And by Eastern meditation, they have an Orientalist idea of what it means mm-hmm. to meditate, what it means to do yoga, and all of this. So I'm interested in a critique of that kind of mindfulness as labor discipline. So I'm thinking about mindfulness as it's sort of spilling out all over. And it's true in Indian corporates, right? And if you have talk to a person in Indian corporate. I have relatives who are human resource managers there, and one of the major things that they're getting, trying to get employees to practice, is forms of mindfulness. In other words, a new form of attention. So that is very interesting to me, and I'm going to pursue it, I think, by going at it through artistic practice. So I've been doing a lot of interviews with artists who have developed different routines through which they contemplate their own practice, contemplate the world, and in that contemplation find what they would call authentic creativity. So yeah, that's what the book is on. It's going to probably be some sort of analysis of what's happening, for instance, and I'm in conversation with several artists in Bombay and artists mm-hmm. here in London, and to see what these different conditions of attention are.
That sounds really interesting, and I can't wait to read it when writing from this project begins to emerge. Thank you so much, Amit, for taking time out to chat with me today. I really appreciate it, and I had a really stimulating start to the morning, I'd say.
Great. Glad to have been in conversation with you, Sneha. Very, very much appreciate it.